Now thought claims attention. That is to say, thought becomes a form. It becomes formal. And feeling becomes like the background. Every time you focus on a form, it's the form that claims your attention, and the background is subconscious, not unconscious. It is there. If you have a cutout form, like I'm holding up a rubber band, one that you can see through, then you're aware not only of the form, but also of the background. This form is abstract. So an abstract form is a symbolic ploy of being able to show you the wholeness of the situation. It's like somebody who is really a genius at that was the old Henri Matisse at the end of his life, would sit there in his wheelchair with brightly primary colored paper and scissors and cut out forms, fantastic abstract silhouettes, and then have them pasted up to his walls where he lived. The whole thing is not that this is a wonderful old master just playing with primary colors and abstract forms, and this is a wonderful design. It's a spiritual discipline for somebody who is very, very masterful at the spirit. Matisse at 80 was incredible. He's showing graphically, without having to say anything more, by this abstraction, one has occur the wholeness of the situation, not just forms, but the background, not just the thought, but the feeling matrix in which it occurs. And also, feelings and the thought matrix in which they occur. In other words, there's kind of like a shock, there's kind of like a surprise that's there when one realizes that the context of feeling is thought. And because it is so radically unexpected, the traditional religious thing is to say that our feelings occur in God's thought. Can hardly believe that it could be yours. But in fact, it is. So that feeling is not subconscious per se, but the images and feeling-toned meaning act more as a subconscious horizon. This apparent sinking of the mythic function into the subconscious gives rise to its complement function, thought. Consciousness now is more characterized by thought, just as feeling is more subliminal. Feeling was coherent by relational pattern. Now thought finds coherency in sequential development. Sequential development. You can see here the root of history, the sequentiality. Notice that it isn't the fact. It isn't the sophomoric chronological facts at all, but that is a structural comportment. And I've got a little project for everyone to work on this so that you can make that clear to yourself. Feeling was coherent by relational pattern. Now thought finds coherency in sequential development. But the new orientation is not familiar, and the old pattern motif still operates, but with a symbolic cast to it. This symbolic style of patterning is distinctive and gives to consciousness now, for the first time, a sense of irony. I have a little parenthetical here. All great magicians are wry. And it's true. The archetype is the cantankerous quality, personally, of Merlin. What does Merlin do? He makes fantastic magic, and on the asides he's muttering to himself, and he's trying to kick things out of the way, and he's just wry, in the sense that irony is the first sense that comes up. How is this so? Because the symbolic frame of reference is blinking in and out with the mythic. You're seeing it like an optical illusion in feeling. You're seeing it both ways, and hence there's kind of like an irony about the whole thing. And a sense of being based not on nature, but on symbols. And in alchemy, is the perfect expression of this distinction. Nature is the lumen naturae, the light of nature. But symbols are the lumen de lumen, the light of light. In other words, the quintessence of light. The lumen de lumen is seeing symbolically. The lumen naturae is seeing naturally. You cannot transmute anything in nature. Nature itself has to be restructured, has to be reinterpreted by the lumen de lumen. Then it can be made into whatever you want to make. The saying, making lead into gold, is a mythic image. That's not what alchemy is about. Alchemy is about transmutation, but making gold is a fool's play. If you had a chance to make something, if you had the powers of transformation, what would you make? You would make yourself real. That's what you would do. The hell with gold. That's nothing. But to become real, that's what you make. Tranquility as a hidden, implicit, certainly eclipses nature and natural cycles of time with conscious psychological time. So that psychological time is what you are looking to understand, and not just clock time. So that history, while initially you think that you're concerned with the chronological natural time, as you work with it consciously more and more, you see that you're concerned with the psychological shape of the interpretation. Now this, the human race has down pat. We have struggled with this particular set of problems so long that we have squeezed out and milked out every possible ounce of permutation in this process. And this process is down perfectly well. And this process occurs in the medieval habit for 1,000 years of making books of hours, which is still going on today, courtesy of one of the students and friends who brought this particular one back from a bookstore in the East, a modern book of hours. What is a book of hours? A book of hours is making the 24 hours of a day and writing down something to be read at each hour of the day in chronological order. Your choice. You make whatever selection, whatever quote is good. What are you going to have as a quote for 3 a.m? It's going to be quite different from 9 a.m. Quite different from 3 p.m. So the medieval process of making a book of hours, 24 sequential quotations or little thoughts, that on each hour you're going to read it and follow through a day like this. And every day will be the same, but it'll all have this kind of a thing. This is a natural time sequencing, which is right on the verge of being transformed. Because one can see that you might have maybe a sentence for 2 a.m, because you're not up at 2 a.m. too awfully much. Whereas at 2 p.m, you might have several pages that you want to have. Notice how you skew the pattern visually. Notice how it becomes reinterpreted to fit your personal life circumstances. Now, by graphically seeing how you reshape the 24-hour day to fit your own day, an insight comes from this, a powerful symbolic insight. And actually, the first people to have this powerful symbolic insight spoke the Greek language. And so the Greek language has, in its very nature, the archetypal power of this realization when it was first fresh in human nature. And when we come back from a break, I'll give you a little bit of the facts on this. You can see. Let's take a break. Molly or Ed or Dave, who've seen this over 4 or 5 years, can appreciate what a different group occurs. It's never the same. And in fact, if I run an image filter through my memory and put together the last 20 years of working on this, or 25 years, I can see that it's really like a weather pattern. The cloudscape is always different and rapidly changing, even though while it's occurring at any particular time or any particular month, it seems like this is really solid, this is really here, it really is kaleidoscopic. So that frequently I'll make little loops to go back and catch certain material up, like I'm doing now, this morning, with some mythic material and bringing it back in a new way, because there are many people who don't remember this or who were not conscious at the time that it was being delivered. It's important in your history section to try to become conscious of where does all this fit in for me. And one of the assignments that's going to be there next week is to write a history for yourself of your history in this educational process. But that is so difficult to do that we're going to have a little prelude assignment of each of you making a book of hours for yourself. And I'll talk more about that next week. But I've got Rilke's book of hours. There's some selections from it. I have the complete book of hours in several translations, but you can see that even someone as sophisticated as Rilke made a book of hours. And here's a recent book of hours. So that this will be a chance, an example for you to do the initial kind of sequencing, chronological sequencing, and notice how it tends to reform itself when psychological time is brought into play. You reinterpret the chronology. The chronology becomes totally different. So that, for instance, in the Old Testament, if you read the Book of Kings, it has a mythic structure. It's all about what happened in terms of the kings. But if you read the Chronicles, the chronicler comes many centuries after, and the Book of Chronicles has a whole different mentality, has a higher consciousness than the composition of the Book of Kings. But when you come to something like the Book of Job, the whole sense of chronology is thrown out of the window. The whole sense of what kings do is thrown out of the window. The sense of what happened to you in this interior journey, that's really what's important. It doesn't matter what the kings did. It doesn't matter whether it's put in the right chronology. The real issue is what's happened to me? How have I come to this pass? And what's going to happen? What's going to come on? So that there is it's like a development line that rises and rises the mathematical term asymptotically. So a sense of history is very high consciousness indeed. And to write your history here, you can see that all of the things that we have done, you can review, and putting them into their sequence first, their chronological sequence, will be interesting to you. But that's only for openers. When you think about it, when you look at it, when you pull out the meaning for it, the weights will change, the values will change, and you will have, finally, hopefully, after about 3 months, you'll have a shape of experience which is memorable. So that while art was about expression, history is about experience. What's important in art is the integrity of the personal expression. And what's important in history is the shape of the experience. And that is something we have to look forward to. I promised you something about time, something about hours, so that you can see. This is from a volume that was published a few years ago by Cornell University Press, Chronology of the Ancient World, Professor Elias Bickerman. And just read this for you because it's of interest to you. The division into hours is first attested in Egypt. In other words, the Egyptians are the first one to have the sense of hour, each hour, each hour, and a sense of sequence of hours. As early as 2100 BC, the Egyptian priests were using the system of 24 hours. Why is that such a significant date? Because that's the time when the divine king archetype first begins to really take hold. The constellator of the divine king archetype, in terms of human history, in terms of a memorable event, was Sargon of Akkad, who did that about 2350 BC. And Sargon of Akkad was really somebody. He was somebody like Alexander the Great was somebody. He was able psychologically to step out of the old mold completely and set a new tone. So that the Egyptian priests were using, as of circa 2100 BC, 2200 BC, a system of 24 hours. One of the Egyptian pyramid texts that I did a lecture on earlier this year was the Egyptian Book of Hours. And if you have those tapes, you can review those. In the 24 hours, they had 10 daylight hours, 2 twilight hours, and 12 night hours. 10 daylight hours, 2 twilight hours, and 12 night hours. This arrangement, based on the decimal method of counting, gave way around 1300 BC to a simpler system which allotted 12 hours to the day and 12 hours to the night. Not only is it simpler, but notice that it's polar. 12 versus 12. Notice the constellation of polarity is in terms of matrices of 12. Who lives about 1300 BC? Do you have any idea? Moses. Constellating wholeness in terms of patterns of 12 is a characteristic, symbolic, visionary talisman of the time of Moses. Is absolutely the strongest shape of that time. Notice that time as a whole, though, is a pair of 12. So there tends to be an archetypal symbolization of 12 hours of goodness and 12 hours of evil, 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness. Notice that constellation. The Babylonians similarly divided the day and the night by 12. That is to say, it was all in the same cultural matrix. If we had the material, we would find that the Harappan civilization in India, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, the Indus civilization also had a 12-12 time period at this time, if they would be there. They were somewhat earlier. The cultures all shared the same archetypal development. The Greeks, according to Herodotus, learned this arrangement from the Babylonians. The Greek term, and then there's Greek letters, omega, which is O, and then the letter for R and the letter for A with an aspirate mark, so it's H-O-R-A, ura, ura, our, ura. The Greek term ura, from which via Latin, hora, H-O-R-A, we get our word hour, originally referred to a season. An hour was a season, spring, summer. Then to the fitting or appointed time. A fitting time was an hour. It's the hour of sweet repose, etc. And he gives us all of the Greek designations for this from Aristotle, from Sappho, from Hephaestus, and many other collections. Beckerman's a very fine scholar. The sense of hour is first attested in the second half of the 4th century BC, the sense of an hour as an hour. Why is it the second half of the 4th century BC? It's the time of Alexander the Great. It's the time when the Hellenistic syncretism is happening, and there's a specificity which is required at this time. And at this time, the first time the expression a half hour appears is in the Greek late playwright Menander, the middle comedy writer Menander, the sense of a half hour, just like our sense of a half hour. The hour of the ancients, however, was not as it is for us. It was not 1/24th part of the whole day, but 1/12th part of the actual length of time from sunrise to sundown, and again, 1/12th of the time from sunrise to sundown and sundown to sunrise. Whatever it was, 1/12th of that was the hour. In other words, notice what is strong here is the archetypal 12-part structure. They're not interested in a scientific hour. They're interested in a symbolic hour. This is not true just for one peoples. It's true of all human beings of this time, across the board. This is what we mean when we're talking about something structural. Notice that it's deeper than tradition. It's deeper than culture. It's in the very structure by which human beings construe themselves, work. So that, thus, the length of an hour varied according to the latitude and the season. The farther north you would get, in the wintertime, the longer the hours and so forth. If you got far enough north, you would get to where you would have in the wintertime, maybe 18 hours of darkness. And you would notice the difference, and you would notice that if you went really far north, you would have complete night. One of the original senses of hell is of a very cold place. Hell is where it is always night. Jeez, we'll get to some place where it's always dark. See? And then the contrapositive of that, someplace that's not only always dark, but always hot. See how those extreme images come together? And it's like an exile from life, from where life can exist. Notice that we're talking now structurally and symbolically. We're not talking religiously at all. But notice that in a mythic, meaningful sense, all kinds of religious associations would come out of the play of these structures. So that if you were not conscious at all, you would be woven into these kinds of associative structures without even knowing that you've been co-opted. This is the original meaning, and the religious meaning at that. Don't be of this world. This world's an illusion. It isn't that it doesn't exist, but that the way in which it exists for you in an automatic sense, an associative sense, may be misleading. In fact, almost always is. Notice that the false extreme is then not to trust nature. There are all sorts of perils, all kinds of perils. So that the hours were reckoned from the rising of the sun, or at night from the coming of darkness. Thus the seventh hour roughly corresponds to our midnight, or midday, and marked the end of business hours. 6 hours are most suitable for toil. He's quoting here from a Greek anthology. 6 hours are suitable for toil, and the four that come after, when shown in letters, say men live. That is to say, you work for 6 hours, and then there are 4 hours that are your time off, and that's where you live. The other hours are like for eating and for sleeping. So when you prorate that, the hours when you would live, when you have your own time, those hours were designated in Greek as the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th hours. And the Greek words for 7, 8, 9, and 10 begin with the letters Z, H, theta, I. So that when you put those 4 hours together, that quaternary of the hours that belong to you, anagrammically, taking the first letter of the Greek numbers, 7, 8, 9, 10, it turns out to be Z-H-O-I, or Zoe, which means life. That time is your life. In other words, everything else is taken up, is sopped up by just struggling to get up to ground zero. Sleeping, eating, working. What's left after that, what's left after the traditional debt that you owe, that's your life. That's your individual life. That's the Zoe. So that you can see how time became, at the time of the great Hellenistic world culture visions, time became a divine image, a God image, which was at once very powerful and at the same time very tyrannical. And the Greek word for the time god was aeon, A-I-O-N. The time god was aeon. And it was a man with a lion's head wrapped with a big serpent. Jung, in his volume, in his collected works on aeon, I believe, in that volume, has an illustration. Let's see if my memory is correct. Yeah. The god Aeon. It's a divine symbolization of time. Notice that life does not occur within the aeonic structure, but life occurs outside of the aeonic structure, outside of time. It occurs where? In eternity. That's where life is. Your reality, when every debt to this world is taken away, your reality is there. So life belongs someplace else. It doesn't belong in time, see. It doesn't belong in this sense. So that there is a there's a tremendous sense about 2,000 years ago of transcending time is to transcend this world, transcending the compulsive temporalization of events, which you are forced to do, to just maintain yourself. There's something above that. There's something beyond that, and that is your life. Can you notice how very graphic the symbolization of this whole thing becomes? And on this, in this manner, by approaching the material like we're doing here, with our slow circumambulation of it and development, you're being able to get a really powerful perspective on what really has happened, what really has occurred, and where we are now. Now, in between art and history, I have an interface. And this interface centers around, I've chosen Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. So I want to give you some of this. I'm going to use the J.B. Leishman translation because I think that that's, even though it's somewhat prim, somewhat British, and we don't really need to be British anymore, it's still fairly close. Let me read you just a little bit of his introduction so that you can place this into perspective. It's the introduction to Sonnets to Orpheus, translated by J.B. Leishman about 50 years ago. When Rilke established himself in the Chateau de Museau near Sierra in Switzerland, in August of 1921, he was nearing the end of his long and lonely struggle to reestablish contact with the past. In other words, Rilke had been uprooted from his sense of personal history. Not only he, but the entire world had been uprooted. What was the uprooting? The First World War. The First World War psychically tore up man's sense of history. The reason why it was called a world war is that everywhere in the world there was a sense of uprootedness. If you look at a picture of human beings, say from 1912, they're all very, very secure. And if you look at a picture of human beings in 1915, everybody's on an edge. And by 1918, 1919, they're tired of being on the edge. They want to play or forget it or do something else. And the quote 1920s, the roaring 1920s, is like a visceral reaction of being on edge too long. It happens. So that Rilke is symbolic for this whole time period. He's symbolic for the world at that occasion. He couldn't write for 10 years. He was dry. Nothing came out. And he tried frantically for years to find something that works. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Until early 1922, and when it came out like that. He wrote everything, everything, in 3 weeks. So that's what we have here. After months of solitary concentration, utterance and release came to him in February of 1922, when, in a tempest of creative activity with which there is no parallel, except perhaps in the lives of some of the great musicians, the elegies were completed, and the 55 sonnets to Orpheus were written all within 3 weeks. Not only the sonnets to Orpheus, but a whole volume of very fine, sophisticated poetry called the Duino Elegies. Duino was a castle on the Adriatic Sea. He'd begun the Duino Elegies in 1912, and he'd written two or three, and then he went dry. And what he was trying to do was get back and finish the Duino Elegies. So at the beginning of February in 1922, he finally was able to get back to the Duino Elegies, but as soon as he did, It was like some spirit, some phantom, took over Rilke's writing, and instead of writing more Duino elegies, he wrote the sonnets to Orpheus. He wrote the whole first part in 3 days. He didn't correct a word. Can you imagine? The first part has 36 poems, 36 of the greatest poems in the European language in 3 days, not changing a word. It's like the diamond power of the inner self when it can speak. It's eloquent in its silence, but from the silence can come a voice which is accurate. That's like the surprise. And Rilke, here in the Sonnets to Orpheus, is a perfect example of how this exactly happens. The task for which he had prepared himself for 10 years had been the completion of the Duino elegies. The sonnets presented themselves to him quite suddenly, as a surprise. They were begun shortly after the inception and finished shortly after the completion of what Rilke himself, although perhaps not all readers will share his opinion, considered to be the greater work. You mentioned the sonnets to Orpheus, Rilke wrote a year later to a friend. Now and then they may show some lack of consideration for the reader. Even to me, they show lack of consideration as the writer. In their rising up and imposing themselves upon me, they are perhaps the most mysterious, the most enigmatic dictation I have ever endured and performed. The whole first part was written down in a single breathless obedience between the 2nd and the 5th of February, 1922, without one word being in doubt or requiring to be altered. And at a time when I had got myself ready for another large work and was already busy with it, how can one but increase in reverence and infinite gratitude for such experiences within one's own existence? I myself am just penetrating more and more into the spirit of this message, which is what the sonnets reveal themselves to be. To another friend to whom he was sending copies, both of the elegies and the sonnets, he wrote, "But it is of the very essence of these poems, their condensation and abbreviation, frequently stating lyrical totals instead of adding up the items necessary for such a result, that they seem intended rather to be grasped as a whole through the inspiration of one who is like-minded than by what is usually called understanding. Where a darkness remains," writes Rilke, "it is of a kind that requires not explanation but inclination. Without a knowledge of certain assumptions and some information about my attitude to love and death, much in these poems may be hard to comprehend." So that gives you just a little bit of an introduction, and I want to read you just a couple of the sonnets to Orpheus. The purpose of introducing these here is that the interface between art and history is coming into contact with this quality of one's inner self. In other words, consciousness does not ever cross that ocean of history without having the deep self-integrity intact. There's no way to cross this world of time if you're frazzled or frayed or incomplete. Such a boat will sink. It won't make it to the other shore. Here's the first of the sonnets to Orpheus. A tree ascending there. O pure transcension, O Orpheus sings. O tall tree in the ear, all noise suspended, yet in that suspension, what new beginning, beckoning, change appear? creatures of silence, pressing through the clear, disintricated wood from lair and nest. Neither cunning, it grew manifest, had made them breathe so quietly, nor fear, but only hearing. Roar, cry, bell, they found within their hearts too small. And where before, less than a hut had harbored what came thronging, a refuge tunneled out of the dimmest longing with lowly entrance through a quivering door. You built them temples in the sense of sound. That's very difficult to translate, so I'll give you another translation of that, which comes from David Young recently. This is the same poem, the first sonnet to Orpheus from the first part. In other words, the first words that came to him, the point, the tip of the rush was, a tree stood up. O pure uprising. Orpheus is singing. O tall tree in the ear. And everything grew still. Yet in the silence, there, changes took place, signals and fresh beginnings. Creatures of stillness crowded from the clear, untangled woods, from nests and lairs. And it turned out that their light stepping came not from fear or from cunning, but so they could listen. Shriek, bellow, and roar had shrunk in their hearts, and while before there was scarcely a hut where they might stay, just a shelter made of the darkest cravings, with shaky posts for an entranceway, you made a temple for them in their hearing. It's about transformation, you see. I'm sorry, I'm unable to read the German forcefully enough to deliver it as poetry. Here's the second sonnet to Orpheus. Notice how Rilke shifts, and he shifts from a kind of a clear, pure, rising kinesthetic quality to a thin, ephemeral, feminine presence. He uses the word which Madchen, maiden, that the presence was feminine, but feminine is kind of like a girlish presence, maiden. And almost maiden-like was what drew near. From that twin happiness of song and lyre, and shone so clearly through her spring attire, and made herself a bed within my ear, and slept in me sleep that was everything. The trees I'd always loved, the unrevealed, treadable distances, the trodden field, and all my strangest self-discovering. She slept the world, O singing God, and stayed while you were shaping her with no desire to wake and only rose to fall asleep. Where is her death? Oh, shall you find this deep, unsounded theme before your song expire? Sinking to where from me? Almost a maid. You can see the enigmatic quality of the second sonnet to Orpheus. It's like there's been a clarion vision, something really definite has made its presence, and then it begins to fade, it begins to atrophy in a way from the clear invisible rising to this kind of mysterious girl-like presence Who knows what's happening? We'll wait for the cassettes.